And hooray for Casey Neal, one of my favorites of his from a long time ago. Yep, we're all riffraff now here at Positively Revolting Talk Radio on Radio Free Cascadia at KBOO. You know, hey, what can I say? I'm proud to be part of the riffraff, and I hope you are too. I'm Melody Silverwolf, and this morning, I wanted to continue the conversation we had 2 weeks ago with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College. Unfortunately, Crystal is off again, that jet setter. Now this time she's in Mexico. Last time she was in Costa Rica. What can I say? She just flits around the world enjoying herself. So she's not here today with me, but I am very pleased to say that Dr. Hart Landsberg is on the phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be with you again.
Well, thank you so much for agreeing to continue this conversation, because we barely scratched the surface last week, or 2 weeks ago, actually. And for those of you who didn't hear the show 2 weeks ago, we basically were talking about the economy and, you know, what the heck do we do about it? Obviously, we're in a pretty big mess, not just in this country, but around the world. And, you know, I basically wanted to have you back because there's so much more that I wanted to talk about. I guess my first question is, how do we really restructure the entire global economy, and not just in our country, but around the world, to provide for everyone in a just way? I mean, I know that's a huge task, but where do we start? What do you think we should be doing in this country and then with other countries in conjunction to try to begin this process?
Wow.
I know that's a huge question.
It is, and my mind is going in different directions. I guess one thing to say is there are, I think the first step is kind of a growing confidence that the way we're doing things doesn't work. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, for many years in South America, in Africa, and in the United States, there was kind of an acceptance of a you know, either forced or acceptance of kind of a free market vision where exports, competitiveness, all that was sort of dominating. And what's became clear in many South American countries is this isn't going to work, and people began to elect presidents like in Ecuador and Bolivia, Venezuela, other countries saying on the campaign of doing something different. And so we do see sort of the start of experiments where five or six countries have come together to form an organization called ALBA, where the basic idea is that state enterprises should come together, create joint ventures, and share expertise and abilities of different countries. So, for example, Cuba would offer health care to Venezuela, and the Venezuelan state energy company would offer help in building energy facilities and infrastructure. Cuba would provide health care to Bolivia. Bolivia would provide soybeans and certain kinds of indigenous medicine know-how. The idea being that what should happen is that public capacity should be built in different countries. The strengths of those different countries can be shared with each other to strengthen national economies. The focus should be domestic, not export. It should be public, not private. And that slowly the attempt should be to create positive, solidaristic relationships, which has been accompanied by the creation of ALBA houses with different cultural activities and exchanges of those, a regional television and radio network to share news about experiments. You have examples like in Venezuela where the government actually set up a supermarket chain that's state-owned, and the purpose of that supermarket chain is to then buy at subsidized prices family organic produce and to offer it in the supermarket chain, with the idea being that that chain would not only provide low prices for people in the areas where they're located, which is mostly low and middle income areas, but would actually subsidize and support people producing decent food, local food, environmentally friendly food, and reduce imports. And so there's kind of this idea of trying to use the public sector not to dominate everything, but as an anchor to create space for local, cooperative, community, smaller scale activities to be run effectively and efficiently in response to public need. Now, I don't think we can sort of take those things ready-made here, but I think there's sort of a similar kind of sense that we have to have here. The free trade agreements that that promote, you know, massive, you know, globalization have really turned out to be bad. And one of the things that's spurring, I think, people to look at South American examples more is that not only were we incredibly import dependent, which was, you know, sustained by all this debt, but you have all of Asia, which is now in a crisis because it built up all of its productive capacities to export all around the world. And as you mentioned, as the world economy goes down, we're seeing massive unemployment in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, problems in China, India, and so they're facing the same thing. Well, now, you know, what did it mean to rely on the market and to build up all these capacities? They were considered the success stories. So I think what's happening is that everywhere we need to sort of say, how do we gain control over resources? I'm circling around to the very question you asked me. And refocus domestically. And I don't think you can do that by relying on the market and pursuit of profit. Trade is important, but it can be done in managed ways, in complementary ways. And so what that requires is some kind of structures of planning. And I don't see any way around beginning to have debates in this country about how to make a responsive, democratically structured public sector that operates at different levels, that is under the control of people, and whose activities can be directed at things we need and we want. And I don't know at this point, or I guess I'm sure at this point, that, you know, people are already reluctant to say, well, we basically own the banking system. What would it mean if we took it over?
Mm-hmm. And that's been discussed recently.
Right. But, you know, it's being discussed by economists to say, well, take it over, but then as soon as we get it fixed up, reprivatize it.
Mm.
And the question for us is, well, what would it mean to have a publicly owned banking sector? How could we imagine it? Or, for example, we have huge budget deficits in this state, California, other places. You know, at best, progressive politicians are saying, what do we have to cut? Where's the money come from? Well, we have lots of needs. What if the public sector actually began providing goods and services for us?
Oh, no, and we can't have that. That would be communism.
Well, exactly. And so it gets swept off the table. But if you say, well, we need things, what if our banks provided loans to our public sector to create basic industries or to run services that we need, and those profits get reinvested back in the community, and we guarantee, you know, decent labor conditions with, sharing workers, you know, worker decision making, so on and so forth, and begin to build a self-sustaining structure of community control and planning. These are really big kinds of changes, but
yes.
The question for me is, where in our communities can we begin to have those conversations? Because short of that, we probably can succeed at patching up this system, but the system wasn't working very well for people even when it did well. And if we continue down this road, it's going to be large majorities who aren't finding things very, very well, very
yes.
good. But it doesn't mean that things are going to collapse. It just means that we're going to continue to live with growing deterioration, growing environmental problems, growing tensions with other countries, growing racism, and, you know, clearly a future that none of us want.
Well, that doesn't, obviously not going to work for anybody. I guess, before I launch on my next point, I want to remind everybody this is a call-in show. We welcome your questions and comments. For Dr. Hart Landsberg, call us at 503-231-8187. I guess my question is, it seems to me that this is impossible to have this discussion without discussing class. That the economy of the United States, since its inception, the United States was seen as a sort of a cash cow, a new continent where we could exploit all the natural resources, and people both basically moved here initially from Europe to make their fortunes. And that now, of course, we have post-Reagan, we've had this huge shift of wealth to the upper classes. And it seems to me that we can't really dismantle this whole, not just our economy the way it's structured, but the whole global economy of the G8-type countries being on the top and some other countries being on the bottom, so to speak, without addressing class somehow. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's one of the things that the capitalist class is fully aware of, that there is class and class interest, and they've done their best that when anyone tries to raise it to, you know, either dismiss it or accuse them of, you know, uncivil behavior.
Mm-hmm. Class warfare.
Class warfare, which is in fact what's happening, but that people refuse to acknowledge that. And I think one of the things that goes on is that people look at people like me, an economist, and say, well, these are technical problems. You know, we need these economists who really understand things, as if there's sort of this one vision, as if it isn't political, you know, how we choose to spend our money, as if it isn't political that when I endorse, you know, globalization and free market economics, I'm not actually favoring certain kinds of values.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, when you look at some of the periods when popular movements were strong, it's because they recognized that they needed to fight for their rights, that this is not a class-neutral system.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a big myth that we like to have in America, that this is a classless society, which, of course, is ridiculous. We have a caller, so let's hear what Paul has to say. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I just have a question for Professor Landsberg, and he's talking about, you know, nationalizing things. Dennis Kucinich says that, you know, nationalizing banks is very dangerous because it can lead to fascism. And I was wondering if the professor could expand on that a little bit, or could explain, you know, what those dangers are, because this is something sort of like beyond my ken, and I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your question.
Well, I do respect a lot of Dennis Kucinich's views, so I'm not quite, and I hadn't heard that one, so, but, I mean, that's like saying, well, if we have a public education system, that leads to fascism. Or a fire department. I mean, what that says is that right now we have a banking system that has grown and a finance system increasingly large, which as of 2007 accounted for 40% of all corporate profits in the United States, that has dominated this economy and has enriched people, the upper class, and distorted the economy based on pursuing private profitability criteria without any care for the stability or well-being of the country. And so it seems to me bringing in those decisions into the public arena is a very important part of democratizing things. I mean, when you went back, when you mentioned, Melody, the early stages of the United States, I mean, people in the U.S. used to talk about that it was the yeoman farmer. It was the independent person, the person who could survive, could, you know, lived on their own work as they viewed it, that person could truly be democratic, mm-hmm. could have a democratic system, because they couldn't be pushed and pulled and blackmailed by other people. They were independent. And as wage labor came into play, of course, they lost that independence. And increasingly then what's happened is that we are dependent on the power and the decision-making of those who control our assets mm-hmm. and our jobs and our revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we regain that independence? There are some activities that are so big and so important in setting a structure for all of us to have some independence that the only way that we can do that, I think, is to have public ownership. Now, there are many different ways of structuring that public ownership, and I think one of the problems is, and we can come back to the banking sector in a minute, is that people do look at the government as an external force that seems to be more threatening to them than somehow private enterprise. And there are many ways, of course, in which the government has been controlled by private enterprise and has done everything for them. But we have to sort of find ways to reconceive of things. And let me just give you one example of public education. And then let's say a word about banking, and then I'll, you know, we can move on to, mm-hmm. to all these interrelated questions.
Yeah, because I've got some callers, too.
Okay, so just a quick example. I mean, we have right now a public education system that's really under attack. There's not a lot of money. In the past, we've had lots of people who have been very critical of, you know, paying taxes for public, you know, salaries for teachers. We've had all this kind of focus on narrow testing because we don't think we're getting the results from our public system, and there's been a lot of criticism of it. But let's step back and say, what if people in the women's movement, the environment movement, the labor movement, and here I'm almost imagining that we have these movements, could sit down and talk with teachers and say, what would a curriculum look like that would really produce democratic activists and respect for work and women mm-hmm. and the environment and anti-racism education? How could you engage students and integrate them in the community and do things? And if teachers can be given space to reflect on that and to develop a curriculum that would be responsive to that, then in return, people could say, yeah, we support that. That's a public education that speaks to us. We want to pay taxes for that, mm-hmm. fair taxes, because our young people are learning to respect these values and to be responsive. And in that sense, public school teachers become our representatives in education. And so it's not like taking the same public system and saying, well, carte blanche. It's a way of saying a public system can be responsive to our interests.
Right.
And we have the ability to make it because the people who work the public system come from us. They're working people like we are. And we in the community have to find ways to build our communities, express our values, engage with our public sector workers, and build systems and processes that respond. Well, it's the same with banking. You can have a national-owned banking system that's broken up into community banks.
Mm-hmm.
You can have, you know, local governments developing criteria, living wage jobs, you know, companies that you know, support workers' rights, environmental stuff, that get priorities on loans. We have to begin to kind of view our own, with confidence, our own ability to structure things, but to really do that in a coordinated way that transforms the economy. I don't see any way around some large-scale public ownership, but public ownership that's truly publicly accountable.
Well, I think that would be a great change. Well, let's talk to one of our callers. Harry, you're on the air. Oh, I guess he gave up.
I talked too long. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. let's try our next caller. You're on the air. Hello? Hello, I can barely hear you. Esteban, are you there?
Yes, hello.
There you are. Yes, you're on the air.
All right, thank you. Thank you, and thank your guests for being here. I have a formula that I wanted to run by an economist because I don't have a computer to figure out the overall cost. My proposal is, if the bailout went to the citizens rather than the corporations and the bank, if we raised all the income level of everyone in the United States to $1 million, taxed them at 1966 levels. When I first started working, I worked for a dollar and a dime. I got the dollar, and the government got the dime, and that covered federal, state, Social Security, and workman's comp. So if you raised everyone's level that isn't already a millionaire, if you raised everyone's income level through the bailout up to $1 million, taxed at 10%, that would go to state, federal, and all the necessary. And then an additional 5%. 1% would go to schools, 1% would go to starting our own national health care, and the other 3% would go to a citizen's bank, and that would be owned by the citizens. So I'm just wondering what that overall cost might be and what the feasibility of that might be.
Well, that's quite a proposal. What do you think?
I don't have my computer in front of me either. I'm not quite sure. I mean, first of all, just to sort of raise those incomes, the question would be, does that go to every person? Does that go to every working person? Will companies that are privately owned decide to leave rather than pay those wages and export back? I mean, there'd be a lot of complications. But I certainly think one thing, you know, I would grab hold of there is exactly what you're saying, a sense of history that, you know, in the past, the top marginal tax rate in the 50s and 60s was like 90%, and even in the 70s was 78%, mm-hmm. and now it's down to 25%, and somehow we keep being told, well, we have to lower the taxes of the rich, or, you know, we're not going to get the innovation and the investment, and we've lowered it, and all we've gotten, as you point out at the beginning of the program, is the most enormous income concentration at the top. So people are afraid of raising taxes, but the point is, whose taxes? And I think the caller is saying that's right. I mean, there's no reason why we can't have, you know, a decent tax system and generate that money back into things that will create the kind of jobs we need. I mean, we have large unemployment, and that, you know, that was certainly not sufficient employment even when things were going well, to create jobs and to create public services that could be, you know, cost a little, that would make those salaries go better. And I think what we need is also to throw in, you know, lowering the work week. I mean, I don't necessarily want to see our system be so consumption-driven. I think we need, you know, good parks, good public transportation, good air, clean water, living wages. But the goal should be not to keep pushing the hours of work up to 40, 50, and that we all have to have these huge incomes to afford houses, but to downscale. And to give us the time to be democratically involved in our communities and to enjoy, you know, being creators of culture rather than consumers of culture.
But that's not going to make rich people any richer.
darn right.
See, this is the whole problem. I mean, where, how do we unplug the how do we get our money back from the super rich, first of all? And how do we unplug this whole, like, for example, as soon as the show is over, my colleague Madeline Martinez and I are going to Salem to lobby the legislature about an economic proposal that we're promoting. And, you know, how do we get, I think we're going to encounter some substantial opposition, in part because some of the wealthy, powerful people who some people in the legislature listen to, don't want this proposal. So how do we disconnect, how do we unplug the wealthy and powerful from being in charge and get our wealth and power back from them? I mean, I think that's a real key part of this.
Well, I'm not sure that we can do it with a proposal. I think what we need is, I remember a long, long time ago in the 80s, Oregon was playing around with a plant closure law.
Mm-hmm.
And I was teaching here at Lewis and Clark College then, and there was the idea was that if plants were going to close and they had more than 50 people, they had to give advance notice to their workers.
Right.
So workers didn't just show up and find the plant closed. And that the community, the state, or the local government could come in and help people move things around. And I remember having my students call legislators and say, well, how are you going to vote? And everyone, oh, we're for that. You know, the workers need this. And as it got close, business kept saying, if you do that, we're not coming anymore. We're not going to open business. Now, these were the same businesses who, in many cases, operated in Europe where there was plant closure laws. And as the vote got closer and closer, my students would report back to me, the legislators saying, well, I really like it, but I don't know. I'm not sure. Would it be? To make a long story short, the measure failed because the legislature didn't support it. Now, the lesson to me was that in Europe, at that time, there was very strong support for that legislation, and so businesses had no choice but to accept it and make their profits within that structure. But in the United States, they could scare people, and people didn't have confidence that if they passed that law and business somehow was going to do something else, that they had the ability through public ownership, public production, tax laws, you know, something to force them to be here. And as a result, business could scare people and scare the elected officials away from doing that. The fact is that we don't have, as a community, the sense that we are trapped in this treadmill, and the more we give them, the more power they have, and the more power they have, then the more they take in terms of their freedom. Lower taxes, more mobility, anything we suggest that slightly looks like it restricts them, they say, oh, you can't do that, because we'll move elsewhere, we'll go elsewhere. Well, until we as a community say, you know, we're not going to play that game. We demand our public officials, you know, not give tax breaks to attract people, you know, or to sort of bid against each other. We demand an end to the WTO, the NAFTA agreements that encourages capital flight. We're perfectly willing to support, you know, public ownership and public employment to provide public services. Until we feel confident about that and can make those claims and those demands, business is always going to scare us, and they're going to scare the politicians. And it's hard for us, no matter how well we develop these proposals, to win them.
Well, yes, and of course now people are even more fearful. People are, like, actually in fear for, you know, having a car to sleep in. I mean, you know, if they don't want to end up on the sidewalk. Well, we've got several more callers. Let's talk to Joanne. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. With all this big events happening in our country, do any of the experts believe the following might happen, that a lot of people, because they need a home and a job, will join the military? A lot of mentally ill people will be put in prison. A lot of people will be put on psychiatric drugs. And also, I imagine that the suicide rate won't get any larger because people will be on psychiatric drugs. So do you want to answer these questions? Or can you?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer all of those things, but I have been reading that people are, the military is seeing this as a bright spot, that there are people, more people signing up out of desperation.
It's terrible.
It is terrible, and, you know, the signs are that in California and many other places, Washington, I'm not sure about Oregon, there will be substantial enough cuts in social programs that there will be more problems on the street. As far as the broader sense, you know, it's hard to say. We don't want to look back at the 30s and imagine, you know, very similar things, but we're close to the complete fraying of a lot of our social infrastructure. And under those conditions, the kind of homelessness, hunger, desperation, cuts in social programs will lead to a lot of problems. And the one group that seems to view this as a positive outcome is the military.
Well, I think it's to their, of course, it's not just the military. They are a visible manifestation of the giant fungus that is the very rich and powerful. You know, I mean, that's where poor people end up when they can't find a job.
Yep.
And it's all linked together, of course.
Yep.
503-231-8187. And our next caller is Scott. You're on the air.
Thanks, Melody. You talk about democratic institutions that normally would be like commercial enterprises. What about in the electric utility business, right here in Oregon, quietly working away, sometimes for almost a half century, are these little PUDs, people utility districts, serving electricity at cost, which is a way of saying without profit. They do it at the bare minimum, try to be very efficient. They have directly elected boards from people that live within the service territory. Direct democracy and electricity combined together as a nonprofit. Why is it that here in the Portland metro area, we've had over 100 years of Portland General Electric and Pacific Power, and people don't even have a clue that these PUDs, except for a small minority of folks, actually exist and what they can actually do?
Yeah, wonderful example. I'm sorry that I forgot that example. It's a great example. KBOO is another example of community ownership in a different form. We have lots of these examples, but somehow we don't have the confidence to pursue them. Partly it's of course the money that the private companies have to confuse and our understanding of these things. But that's a great example of public power that has shown that it works, that's shown it's responsive. And it's efficient, and yet it becomes invisible. And of course, we have all these problems of a media that's not responsive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, KBOO, the Portland Alliance, other things. We as a community need to be embracing these institutions and promoting them, and they should become major sources of news and major outlets for participation of different groups to be sharing information. We need ways of building our own infrastructure of organizations, information sharing, mobilization based on, a clear, and getting back to your class, comment, a clear class perspective on what we need. The Oregonian years ago went through a major union struggle where to introduce technologies and things, they ended up locking out workers. Workers left. Workers formed their own newspaper in Portland for a while.
Professor, can I add one more thing?
Yeah.
I think what's also important is not just that PUDs can offer electricity at cost, but the fact that the choices of where your electricity comes from are also democratically based. So an example would be, let's say that I've heard new programs where there are these new small nuclear power plants that are like the size of a school, and they're modular, and you can just have one or 25 or 50, and they could be in neighborhoods. And they're going to be buried under the ground with flowers on top, so they're nice and pretty. Well, now, if Portland General Electric decides that that is okay with them, that they're okay with the technology, there is no democratic decision. But if the citizens of Portland say, we don't want to have any nuclear power, we want to invest all of our future infrastructure money into wind, solar, et cetera, that is actually something that can be demanded by the voters that actually pay the bills and send their representatives to these boards, where PGE, as an example, lastly, is the current chairman was the head of the Nuclear Policy Institute and said that the way to save global warming or to save the planet from global warming is through nuclear power plants, and he is the chairman of the board of Portland General Electric.
Great.
So thank you.
Yeah, great statement.
Well, so I think that's a good point that, we really do need to take our power back as people. But I think that we are so people have lost heart, or I think some of the recently, with the election of Obama and the increasing awareness and anger of the middle class, I think is a good sign. But
yeah,
we still have so far to go. One thing I want to ask you before we go to another caller is, Do you think that, I mean, what do you think of the future of capitalism is? I mean, it seems to me that capitalism was doomed from the start because it presumes an infinite a flow of resources on a finite planet. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think we're coming, I mean, there's sort of these two crises. One is sort of the instability of production, that comes a lot from the fact that, you know, the point of view of a capitalist is to get the most out of its inputs to get the maximum amount of production and profitability. And so it's trying to produce the very most while minimizing its costs through exploitation. And those costs are both the environment and our own well-being as workers and remuneration. And what happens is you get these sort of cycles of overinvestment, overproduction, and destruction of the environment that underpins our life and the production system. And what capitalism has been able to do, because part of what that system means is that it takes away all the power from the people, is that often when these crises happen, capitalism has been able to push all the costs on other people.
Mm-hmm. They're very good at that.
Exactly. And so what happens is we continue to sort of move through this, but at ever higher and higher cost. And, you know, in the core countries, we've been able to push a lot of the costs on to people in other countries. And that's where, you know, imperialism and, mm-hmm. and exploitation comes from. But a lot of those are now coming home to roost here
because
of the stage of capitalism. But I'm not sure that the system will sort of destroy itself and sort of leave us the ability to pick up the pieces. I think we really have to confront it and engage it. But I think your main point is one that I agree with. I think it's a very destructive system, and it's a very exploitative system and an unstable system. And the whole basis of the system, given that it's that private profit drive, which sees all these resources as nothing but inputs to exploit more effectively for profit, you know, is not a system that has a basis that we want to build on.
Well, it just seems really anti. It's the whole purpose of an economy is to provide for people's, you know, needs and reasonable comfort, and it seems like we've lost that somewhere along the way. Well, let's take our next caller, Mike. You are on the air.
Well, thank you, boy. This is a great show.
Thank you.
I just want to really commend the last caller too. I really think this is the moment to really move to take control of our energy sources. Another kind of project that some of us are talking about, and we're kind of developing, you know, kind of a game plan on, is, and it's a little more short term, is a concept saying tax the bailout. I mean, we've identified enough the banks that got the major bailouts and the portion of their business activity in Oregon, and we want to say, okay, don't go down in the legislature and tell us they got to cut social services because we don't have any money. We need to put a surcharge on the amount that these banks have received from the bailout and just tax them.
Well, there's an interesting concept.
Yeah. I think it would really work. I think it's simple. Everybody, you know, Barney, there was a great quote from Barney Franks. He's talking to some of the bankers and saying, you know, everybody hates you, and they're starting to hate us because we're hanging around with you.
I love Barney Frank. He just speaks to it.
Yeah. And so, you know, because, you know, and our wonderful Democrats are in control of the legislature, and Margaret Carter holds a hearing and says, okay, come down and tell us what we ought to cut. Well, screw that. Let's tax this bailout. Let's go to U.S. Bank and Umpqua and Bank of America and the portion of the, you know, they're all incorporated to do business in the state of Oregon. Let's put a surcharge on the amount they got from the feds. We'll take that money and make sure that there is adequate social service.
That's a great idea. Thanks for that call.
Sure.
You know, I think that's really the kind of direction we need to go. I think that to go back to, I mean, I think we have to be fighting at this level, but I think we also need to be fighting to create the communities that can make the demands.
I think you're right there.
And I think, you know, for me, we have things like neighborhood associations. They need to be arguing for, you know, providing meetings and locations for tenants, for homeless people, for people facing foreclosure, for, you know, services. We have unions. The union meetings need to be places where people are talking about, you know, living wages, public authority, taxing to protect services. We have public sector workers. They need to be finding ways through their unions to be meeting with people who are using public services to make sure they're not being pitted, you know, where education against welfare, against, you know, against roads. We need to be creating communities where people can identify, come for information, to become empowered, and then to put some force behind these demands. I mean, as the callers are coming through, these aren't things that economists necessarily know how to do either. People know how to do these things. They have ideas, and if we had communities and we had our means of information, we stimulate our ideas and we create a basis for pushing back against people who do have a very clear agenda. And that's,
yes,
to, you know, when you look at, for example, like the stimulus plan, which was like 40% tax cuts, all economists who have done studies, they create these input-output tables. They have relation. The government creates an input-output table that tells you how all the sectors are related. And we can model this and say, if you spent $1 billion for educational services, or $1 billion for military spending, or $1 billion for tax cuts, what kind of jobs do you create?
Mm-hmm.
And all the survey, all the studies show, for example, that $1 million spent on, so you look at the direct spending, you look at the indirect spending of the businesses that will provide the services for that spending, and you look at the induced spending, where people who make money, then how do they spend money? And all the results show that educational services creates by far the most jobs, followed by public infrastructure and green investment. Way down is household consumption, and the bottom is military spending. So what was, you know, what was cut was educational spending,
mm-hmm.
Also, you know, green investments. And what was made elevated very high was tax cuts.
So basically we're shooting ourselves in the foot.
Well, but the reason is that, for the reason that you mentioned earlier in the program, which is that tax cuts ensure that the structure of the system doesn't
mm-hmm.
change.
Exactly.
And they're willing, because of their own interests, to allow the system to go as far down as it may go, as long as the structure of the system doesn't change.
Yes.
And if the structure of the system is going to change, it's because people have confidence that they can build something new, and that requires a sense of collectivity and solidarity and an experience that suggests other visions are possible. And we have that experience, but we're so atomized now.
Yes.
That we don't, you know, we don't trust that we can do things together, so all we can try and do is make our way in through the existing system.
I guess this is one of the reasons I wanted to do these shows, is I'm really hoping that, you know, the people who are listening to this show, and I know there's a lot going on in this community, we're very activist around here, that somehow this can be one of the, this can spark a node of discussion, and if there's nodes of discussion like this all over the country and all over the world, that eventually they'll grow together and make these changes. Well, before we go on, I want to tell everybody really quickly what's coming up on KBOO this morning. After this show's over at 9, you'll hear a special for Black History Month called Mexico's African Root, Mexico's Third Root. Host Carlos Chavez interviews Maria Elisa Velasquez on the history and culture of Mexico's African Root. At 10, we'll hear Linda Olsen Osterlund interviewing Chuck Sodetic about the first international war crimes tribunal since World War II. He's the co-author of Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. At 10:30, the topic is the future. The guest is Catlin Gable teacher Mark Lawton, who will talk about the findings of his study of the field of future studies and its implications for education. At 11, Air Cascadia, news and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. And 11:15 on Flashpoints, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn speak about their plans to build a modern movement for peace, and Greg Palast critiques Obama's economic recovery plan. I'm going to have to check that out. All that's coming up on KBOO very soon. And we are just currently talking with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, professor of economics at Lewis and Clark College. This is his second show in a row. And I'll tell you, this is such a great topic. I don't want to leave it. Our number is 503-231-8187. And our next caller is Barth, and you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I enjoy the professor. He's bright and not overly complex.
Thank you.
In terms of your presentations. I missed the earlier part of your show, but from an economic standpoint, I happened to be scanning across my cable last night and saw a presentation from the University of Pennsylvania on C-SPAN and they had six or eight talking heads on a stage saying, oh, well, you know, this, the readjustments that are going on right now are, you know, blah, blah, this and that. But they talked about how the Federal Reserve was possibly having its independence compromised by the funding. But thankfully, our new head of Treasury is from the Federal Reserve system, so he knows what the problems are and how to work with them. And soon after this stabilizes, they will be able to be independent again.
I think he probably created the problems.
Well, but they were saying that you need a national bank to set financial policy, et cetera, et cetera. And these guys were apparently tenured professors of economics at the University of Pennsylvania. I think that's what scanned across the bottom of the screen. I didn't watch it very long, but it was, you know, just almost jaw-droppingly odd that this was being embraced and broadcast. Okay, we live in lefty Portland, and so we may have access to different opinions. Thank you, KBOO. It was amazing, and they were getting questions from the audience.
Could you repeat? I'm not sure I fully followed. The argument was that the banking system is losing its independence to the Fed?
Well, no, that the Fed, because of recent systems decisions through Treasury, that the Fed was going to get money, or there was some kind of federal pressure, U.S. federal pressure, to tilt the Fed one way or the other, and that Bernanke, et cetera, were working together.
That somehow the Federal Reserve, which is supposed to be independent and not part of the executive, is now being brought in and being told what to do for political reasons.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And that, fortunately, the top figures at both ends are old friends or co-workers, and
yeah.
So they know how to work together well, and soon this misstep will be over, because there's a danger that the government and the government's influence might flaw the independence.
Like that never happened before under the Bush administration or anything. No.
Well, the funny thing is that, you know, they're not independent. They're so in league with sustaining a private profit-directed finance system.
Exactly.
That anything that upsets that is almost seen as revolutionary, because both Bernanke and Geithner, and, you know, before him, Paulson. I mean, these people are so concerned to say over and over that, you know, well, we can't really put limits on executive compensation because we'll lose the best and the brightest.
Well,
we're
going to
buy stock, but we're not going to have voting rights. We're going to give money, but we're not going to put requirements on how the money is used, because obviously, you know, these people, you know best. And so what's happened is, of course, that this is an example where it's not just enough to have public, you know, to say let the public institutions do things, but we have to have a clear sense of what our demands are. And if we have these clear evidence that people aren't using our money to do what we want, then, you know, we need to make sure that they do, and the best way to do that is to take them over. But what we have is the Treasury and the Federal Reserve creating this firewall, saying, because, you know, who are these people? They come right out of that same finance system. And so what they do is turn our attention and say, oh, is the Fed's independence compromised because they may have to be responsive to public policy? I mean, in fact, their whole history is to be responsive to private interests.
Right. Well, the same point you're bringing up about tax cuts, et cetera, being the driver that certain segments of the elected officials want to use to, quote-unquote, fix the economy. You know, that by its nature keeps the system intact.
Yep.
This funding is a closed loop.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
A lot of
it that way.
Well, it's almost incestuous the way that government and big business and regulation and big business, and in this case finances and the Fed and big business, are just, you know, this interlocking series of rather corrupted circles.
Well, and I think, you know, the tragedy or the frustrating part of all this is that, you know, except for places like KBOO and shows like this and the Portland Alliance and, you know, a network of national, you know, newspapers and blogs and things that are good but unfortunately small, the majority of people who try and be educated, who watch programs, who read newspapers, get totally mystified. So they aren't given an analysis that really reflects their interests, and so they end up saying this is complicated. I trust the experts, and what we have, of course, is a system with experts who view things in a particular way that don't serve our interests. So we're told, oh well, this stimulus will have, you know, for example, executive limits on executive compensation of $500,000, as if this is so low that, you know, I mean, this is like the top 2% of income earners.
How could you expect anyone to live on that?
There are so many loopholes in that. You can still give out deferred stock. It just means that that the executives can't command the stock until after a certain period has gone by. But then they could be given as much stock as they want and cash in for as much money as they want. And if it's not a particularly structured bailout, you can still ask the stockholders for permission to give huge bonuses. I mean, there's not really honesty going on as to what's happening.
Well, it's just ridiculous to me that they actually believe the American people should feel sorry for them that they can't live on $500,000 a year.
I know.
Poor
exactly.
Babies. Well, it occurs to me that now would be a good time to give out the number for Congress. Yes, indeed, folks. If this conversation is inspiring you to say something to your congressperson, here's the telephone number for Congress, and you can get any congressperson's office by calling 202-224-3121. That is 202-224-3121.
I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
Oh, no, please,
okay.
Go ahead.
I know we're getting near the end, but yes. I wanted to just say one thing that's sort of a pet peeve for me that again, is a distortion, and that's the question of Social Security.
Oh, yes.
And it's coming because as the deficit, you know, is viewed as now the most, you know, threatening thing to our economy by some people because public spending might change structures, people are saying, well, we need to cut back on entitlements, the Social Security is on the verge of collapse, this and that. The reality is that there's absolutely no Social Security crisis, that it's an entirely artificial creation, and here's what I mean about this. First of all, everybody pays Social Security on just their labor income up to a maximum of about $110,000. Everyone pays, I think it's 12.6, so 6.3% individual workers pay in, 6.3% the business pays in. But if you make more than $112,000, you pay nothing in above that level. Now, because of income inequality, more and more labor income is now being untaxed. If we were to remove the cap on labor income so that everyone paid the same percentage of all their labor income, there would be no Social Security crisis.
Mm-hmm. I think that would be really fair.
Beyond that, if you go to the Social Security Administration website and look at their assumptions for the economy, they have to make assumptions about what growth will be, what productivity will be, what immigration will be, and then they look and say, will the system be sustainable? And they have to do this for 75 years out. Now, even those who say Social Security will collapse are saying it will collapse 40 years out, which, you know, we know economists and their track record is not very good. But if you look at their assumptions, they are assuming that the economy will grow over the next 50 years at about 1.9%, which is an extremely low rate of growth for 50 years. If you assume the historical rate of growth in the post-World War II period, there is no economic crisis.
And I've heard that from other sources as well, and I think it's basically a excuse to raid the fund.
Exactly. Their goal is to take our money and put it in the stock market to boost up stocks for the benefit of the investment houses. And yet there's an example where we get frightened into thinking, oh my goodness, the public sector can't do public power, it can't do public health, it can't do public retirement. We've got to trust the private sector. And it's generated by misleading statistics.
Yes. Well, you know, we have very little time left. I think we can squeeze one last call in pretty quickly. So, Yvette, you're on the air, but you got to be quick.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that a number has been researched, which is very relevant, and it's a worldwide monthly income that everyone can survive on, or which is equal, I should say, mm-hmm. for everyone, in that it's $200 a month in U.S. dollars. And so this, to me, puts possibly many of these conversations, makes them irrelevant. So I'm wondering, how can we survive? Can we have radio on $200 a month, or do we choose to starve children, for every $200 over that, we receive? And maybe I'm not saying it right. But
in other words, if everybody shared equally, that the global income would be $200 a month per person.
Yeah, and beyond that, we're starving children every month.
All right, well, thanks for that.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
Did you have a comment about that?
Well, I'm not sure that number represents
what was said.
It seems
awfully low.
But there's no doubt that there's wealth in most of the third world. But who owns it and mm-hmm. how it's organized and for what purposes keeps most people poor?
Exactly.
It's not that we don't have the capacities and the resources and the skills to create societies that meet our needs. And some of that can be done for low amounts of money. Some of it requires more money. But there's no reason that we need to accept limits that can't sustain us.
I think that's so true. I want to thank you again for being my guest, the second show in a row.
Oh, I
it's
enjoyed
been
it.
Wonderful.
And learned from it.
I'd like to have you back again soon. And this has been Dr. Hart Landsberg from Lewis and Clark College. Thanks very much. And we really appreciate your expertise because we need it now more than ever. And I hope that we can indeed have these community conversations that you were referencing that we need to have about the economy and about our future. This is our world, our planet, and we need to make the decisions about how to have our economy. Thanks a lot. Farewell. And to all of you out there, I want you all to keep on being positively revolting. Go out there and live. Have a good one.